You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong tuk ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday, the 4th of December. My name is Justin, and just in case you're wondering where Mary Margaret is, we have a small change today. I will be hosting and she's on the producer's chair. And speaking of producers, Ben is here as well after doing the news. How are you guys today?
Good afternoon.
I'm pretty chill, eating some pineapple.
It's so rainy today, eh?
Yeah, it's crazy.
And there was crazy lightning. There was bad lightning at Tamaki Drive when I was driving in, like crazy fork lightning. Just letting all our listeners know.
I need to get used to it being dark in December before I go overseas. So.
Anyway, coming up on the show today, the Ministry of Health has just released a report of the inquiry into mental health services, and Mary Margaret is giving a quick update on what has been released. For this week's Worry Week, I spoke to Steve Ratuva on the history of the militarization of the Pacific. Mary Margaret also gives a report on more developments from Parliament about bullying accusations. Bean discusses tourism fatigue and how we need to avoid it in New Zealand. And finally, on Green Desk, Ella talks to John Sullivan about an app named iNaturalist New Zealand. As always, he aha o whakaro, get in touch with us with any thoughts you have. Tukapatuhi mai, you can do so by texting us on 5395, or why am I? Give us a call on 309-3879.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
As we speak, the Ministry of Health has just now released the report on an inquiry into our mental health services, so I've gathered a little update on that headline for you guys. An inquiry into the state of mental health services in Aotearoa has been going on for the last 10 months. Last week, the Ministry of Health received the findings. Today, Minister David Clark is releasing the report of the inquiry in full. Minister Clark called mental health and addiction one of the country's most pressing problems, saying that what is immediately clear to him is how much more support needs to be given. He believes that the first step is to put people at the centre of the new approach, an approach that he says will take years to fix, given the magnitude of issues. The 40 recommendations made by the inquiry report are the starting point, and primarily they involve reforming the current Mental Health Act, establishing a new commission on mental health, expanding access to services and the choice of services, strengthening the non-governmental organisation sector, promoting prevention through the enhancement of early intervention, and involving whānau in the care and support of family members. The Ministry's formal response will be in March of 2019.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
And if you'd like to read that report for yourself, you can find it at www.mentalhealth.inquiry.gov.nz/inquiry-report/.
Thanks very much, Mary Margaret. And up next,
what are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
Yes, this week's Wire Worry Week is about the militarization of the Pacific. While many of our knowledge of its history started from the Pacific War during the 1940s because of all the movies and the testimony we always hear, the first history originated way back in time in the 19th century. I spoke with Professor Stephen Ratuva from the University of Canterbury, and we first discussed why the Pacific started to become militarised at that time.
In the 1800s, there were a number of colonial powers which were involved in the Pacific. Britain, Germany, France, of course, and the United States. They were involved in the imperialistic agendas, colonisation. And for the purpose of securing resources and also for strategic reasons. It was a time when the world was being divided up between the big powers. So, the military contestation actually had its roots then. The states in Europe, when they sent out the explorers, they were very much linked to the military as well. And colonization was were linked to military interests as well. So, in the early days, the big powers were involved in contestation over the various islands in the Pacific. So the British were, of course, the biggest colonial powers in the Pacific, and then the French as well, and as well as the Germans. So during the First World War, the Germans lost their colonies in the Pacific, places like Nauru, Samoa, which was lost to New Zealand. New Zealand troops were sent over to Samoa to take over the islands in 1914. So there was a constant reconfiguration of the geopolitical map of the Pacific over the years as a result of the shifts in the military balance of power in the Pacific. So yes, it goes a long way back in relation to the way in which the big powers were competing for possessions, were competing for strategic interests and resources in the Pacific.
Did the European Empire change any of the ways of the Pacific people?
Well, colonialism took place at different levels, at different ways in which it was manifested. At one level was the imposition of a new state, fashioned along the lines of the European state system. And in the process of doing that, the local system of governance was being reconfigured, not totally destroyed. What the British did was to use some of the traditional institutions and reconfigure them to suit their interests, whether it's the chiefly system or the land-owning system, the social structures and the communal system within the villages. They did that in a way which served their interests. They did that in Fiji and many other places in the Pacific. The French, on the other hand, were much more into a total imposition of French values. Anyone who came under French rule was supposed to be French, theoretically, and spoke the language, drank the wine, and lived the culture. And so there was a kind of total transformation of the individual personalities as well as the communal identity. While the British, they kept a distance and under what they referred to as indirect rule. So they used local chiefs, they used local middlemen, as it were, political middlemen, to rule on their behalf, because it was cheaper, much more effective as well to do that. So there was a lot of transformation taking place in relation to resources being taken out. In Fiji, for instance, Indians were brought in to work in the sugar plantations, and all the profit which were made was siphoned back to Australia and to Britain. So the colonies were actually used by the colonial powers, not only in the Pacific, but elsewhere in Asia and Africa, as a means of enriching, not so much enriching the colonies, but enriching the colonial powers. So London, Berlin, Paris were built through the resources which were actually taken away from the colonies. So on one hand, you had the enrichment and the growth in wealth of the colonial powers. On the other hand, was the use of cheap labor, use of resources in the colonies, as well as in a lot of cases, destruction of the local socioeconomic systems.
Did that change indigenous warfare as well?
Oh, it did change indigenous warfare because the introduction of guns, for instance, was quite significant in many ways because it helped a lot of some of the chiefs became powerful and were able to conquer other chiefs as well. So wars became bloodier because you could shoot from a distance rather than go close and use a club, so, you know, or spears. So I mean, in the Pacific itself, tribal wars was part of the political process as a way of settling disputes over land, over power, over resources, as well as women. So a lot of the weaponry which were made during the pre-colonial days by the indigenous groups in the Pacific was largely revolved around the culture of politics in those days, which revolved around warfare as well. So when guns were introduced, they simply added to the already existing culture of warfare, which was in existence, to European contact. So, and also the locals learned a lot from the European warfare, from not only from the guns, but also the nature of battlefield organization and the command structure, and all those things were incorporated into the local systems of warfare. The Tongans, they learned from the British, and the Fijians learned from the British as well. And same thing in New Zealand as well. Although they were the war between the Maoris and the British. And also the British, they learned from the Maoris the use of trench warfare, for instance. So everybody was learning from each other, from both sides, in terms of how to fight war. War, of course, is basically an extension of politics. Every society fights wars. There were wars in Europe in those days. There were wars in the Pacific. There were wars all over the world.
Do you think the military still plays a strong role in the Pacific today?
Well, there are only about four countries in the Pacific with militaries. Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Tonga, and Vanuatu. But Vanuatu has a paramilitary. So in all these countries, Fiji in particular, the military plays a very significant part in the political process. It has been since 1987. And the Fiji military actually has a long history, which goes back to the 1800s, to the late 1800s. And then it evolved over the years. And then 1987 was the first coup, and then there were subsequent coups. Papua New Guinea, the military is not as strong. It's very divided along tribal line. And it's very difficult to have a coup in Papua New Guinea because the military is not strong enough to be able to sustain its rule over a vast territory. Papua New Guinea is very big. They have a military which is relatively small. So it won't be able to control the entire country if there's a coup. And secondly, because it's so divided, one faction who tries to stage a coup will be negated by another faction. So, and also, because there are more guns outside the military than within the military in Papua New Guinea. Now, in Vanuatu, the military is basically divided into two. You have the police, who wear blue, and the military, who wear green. So they're part of the same force. And every now and then, they fight amongst themselves over, you know, who should lead the institution, and other factors as well. Now, Tonga, the military is directly under the king, not the government. So something like Thailand, where the king controls the military, the commander gets his orders directly from the king rather than from the prime minister. So you have four different types of militaries altogether, which have their own historical background, and also they have their own institutional identities, which are quite different.
In your own opinion, when you look through the whole history between 1800s and today, do you think militarization has fundamentally changed the Pacific?
Oh yes, militarization has fundamentally changed the Pacific in different ways. During the Second World War, there were a lot of changes which took place. Militarization was taking place at different levels. You have, if you like, the global and regional geopolitics. During the Second World War, the Americans became the dominant power. The Japanese tried to invade the Pacific from the north. So after the Second World War, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand became the dominant forces in the Pacific. And of course, you had the Cold War, which took place after the Second World War. The Soviet Union had their base in Vladivostok, which is in the Pacific. So the U.S. had military bases all around the Pacific, from U.S. mainland, Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, the Marshall Islands, and Australia, New Zealand. They have links to the American military empire through their surveillance system. And in the Philippines, in Japan, South Korea, these are all part of the kind of anti-Soviet network within the Pacific. And of course, now the rise of China has changed the dynamics dramatically. So the small island states in the Pacific were drawn into the Cold War in different ways. In 1986, the Pacific Island countries, including New Zealand and Australia, they came up with the South Pacific Nuclear Free Treaty, Nuclear Free Zone Treaty, which declared the Pacific nuclear free, and the United States was not very happy with that. So, yes, a lot has happened in terms of the geopolitics of the Pacific, in terms of militarization of the Pacific. And, of course, now, with the rise of China, Australia is trying to remilitarize. New Zealand has been having an independent foreign policy in the Pacific. It actually, over the years, has been cutting down on its military. But recently, we're looking at how it can re-engage with the Pacific through the Pacific Reset as well as engage with Australia and the United States in relation to how it responds to the Chinese, what is seen as a Chinese threat in the Pacific. So the geopolitical shifts in power in the Pacific and the way in which militarization has changed has had some influence in the way in which regional geopolitics has transformed in the last decades or so.
Worry Week on The Wire.
Ko te Wire Tene Marunga BFM. That was Steve Rotuva talking about the history of the militarization of the Pacific. We'll be right back after this. This is She Speeds from Straitjacket Fits.
December 8th at the Power Station. 95 BFM presents Straitjacket Fits and Dimmer.
Home for deep bass. space-filled good times this New Year's with Action Bronson, Chasing Status, Joey Badass, Pendulum Live, Shapeshifter, The Upbeats, DJ Storm, Caliber and DRS, Montel 2099, State of Mind, Mellow Downs, the Katayanagi Twins, and so much more. This will sell out. Northern Base, December 29th to the 31st in gorgeous Mangawhai. Don't miss out. Final release tickets on sale now from northernbase.co.nz.
Christmas is a bone-achingly awful time of year. Itchy tinsel, cloying carols, and the creepy Queen Street Santa isn't even really creepy anymore. Just terrible.
Christmas, more like pissmas.
Lucky for you, there's Real Groovy Records, remaining excellent through the years and changing seasons. Corporate free since 1981 and open right up till the big day. Their incredible unparalleled range of gifts might even make your special somebody's Christmas slightly less shit. Real Groovy, 369 Queen Street, or online at realgroovy.co.nz.
Mummy, how do I keep on the cutting edge of great new music?
Well, when a DJ loves a record very, very much, they do a special kind of cuddle.
Never mind, I've sorted it out.
The answer to your problems. Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a lovingly curated collection of what's new, what's hot, and what's good in music. December features Whānau Spa, Michelle McCure, Earl Sweatshirt, Earth Tongue, and more. 95BFM's monthly Spotify playlist. Stay au fait.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Now, Mary Margaret has got a story for us.
I do. So more stories have developed surrounding the issue of workplace treatment in Parliament after two investigative journalists at the Weekend Herald broke a story about Nationals North Shore MP Maggie Barry. Last week, Speaker of the House Trevor Mallard announced a major independent external review of bullying and harassment behaviour in Parliament between politicians and their employees. It followed the revelation of a number of different issues. They included Mekified City, Jamie Lee Ross, and now Diane Maxwell and Maggie Barry. The National Party had already announced a review of its own working environment because several of the allegations that surfaced during Jamie Lee Ross's resignation illustrated ways in which the culture may not be safe. Since then, over the weekend, the Herald's Kirsty Johnston and Derek Cheng revealed that this year, two of Maggie Barry's four office employees accused Barry of bullying and left. Parliamentary Services interviewed her earlier this year during a quiet investigation of those accusations. At the time, Barry denied using any of the derogatory language that allegations against her had detailed. However, the Herald story included details of recordings of Barry using phrases similar to what she had denied using. That evidence itself has become contentious, as Barry did not consent to their release, and so she may refer the matter to the police. It is unclear at this point how either Parliamentary Services or the Independent Review may reconcile this. What's more, Parliamentary Services is not subject to the Official Information Act, and the external review has not begun yet, so it is unclear what findings might be exposed. But what we can see already is how this is another important piece in the puzzle of shining a light on many of the ethical issues in our workplaces.
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Thanks very much, Mary Margaret. And now Ben has a story for us on tourism.
I do. So a tourism symposium will be held in Auckland this week that will focus on working against tourism fatigue. And this is quite an interesting term. Even more interesting is that the Tourism Export Council of New Zealand don't actually believe tourism fatigue is something we're suffering from here yet. I spoke with Julie Chen of the TEC about what tourism fatigue is.
Tourism fatigue is a term used when people feel that the benefits of visitors bringing to their community are being outweighed by the perceived disruption. So, you know, in some, I guess, overseas cases, we have seen that happening in some of the very major destination spots, like Venice or Barcelona. But in New Zealand, we're certainly not seeing that yet, but we need to prepare ourselves so that we never get to that stage in New Zealand.
And what sort of things are going to be discussed at the symposium this week?
Yeah, so in terms of tourism fatigue, often it comes from the pushback of communities and a lot of the more social and people side of challenges. So at the symposium, you know, we're going to be looking at, we have Alison Taylor, who is the Chief Executive of Centre for Social Impact, coming to speak to us on really, you know, highlighting on, you know, do businesses have a role in enabling social impact? And what that means, you know, we can adopt in the tourism sector. And also, you know, issues around, for example, diversity and inclusion as well will be discussed, where we have Diversity Works New Zealand speaking to us. And again, is really highlighting, you know, as an industry, how can we, you know, make sure that we are planning forward in this topic area. So again, we can prepare our people and our communities in sort of delivering that visitor experience that our visitors are expecting.
Do you find it's a bit of a fine balance between keeping New Zealanders happy and protecting the industry at the same time?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it is definitely works required from all parties, and I think there's a lot of educational aspect to this as well. I think in some areas of New Zealand, often there's potentially a lack of understanding what tourism really means and the value of tourism for their community. So it's potentially highlighting some of those benefits. It's not only obviously the largest export earner in New Zealand, but it's also a great employer of New Zealand in terms of the sector. So really highlighting, you know, for tourism, you know, I know I've spoken to some of the parties in and around communities where they're using tourism ventures as an avenue for, you know, getting their youth into the workforce, addressing youth unemployment. So there's certainly benefits that we can really derive from driving a successful and just sustainable and profitable tourism sector.
You know, you mentioned Venice earlier. When I was there a few months ago, it felt like the locals were gone just about. It felt like it was Airbnbs, hotels, restaurants. What went wrong? Well, what's gone wrong in places like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't sort of comment probably too specifically about Venice, but I think in general that sort of cohesiveness between the local community and the visitors is potentially lacking, and they probably haven't planned that growth together. I think as an industry, we really do need to work on this together as a whole, and we have a common goal to achieve. So, you know, so none of our communities become like that, where, you know, the locals feel like they're being driven out of their own area. And, you know, we certainly, the whole point of having tourism in our country and having it so successfully and is to enrich the lives of New Zealanders in our community. So if it's not doing that, that's when we really need to make sure that we are addressing it.
Do you think New Zealand's small scale might make us particularly susceptible to tourism fatigue?
I think our small scale is probably all relative, because, you know, we've got, you know, some destinations, because they've got such small scale, and then when you see that big influx, that's when you could really see the difference or the impact. However, you get cities like Barcelona where they've got a massive local population, but you could still experience that kind of challenge. So I think it is really more about how you manage it together, and it's not just a private sector or public sector effort. I think, you know, we all need to work together with government as well as the private sector to really address it.
How do you think New Zealand is regarded worldwide at the moment in terms of our tourism offerings?
Yeah, no, it's very highly regarded. I mean, there's been various annual reports that have come out where our visitor satisfaction level is very high, and it's maintained very high, and we certainly want to be able to continue to deliver that, and that's why as an industry we have recognised, you know, due to some of our capacity and infrastructure challenges, we really need to be in the forefront of addressing those and making sure that we are managing our growth sustainably.
So around $87 million is going to be pumped into tourism on the West Coast as part of the Provincial Growth Fund. What's been your response to that?
Yeah, no, it's actually great seeing a number of the PGF projects have been granted in relation to tourism ventures, actually. So not just in West Coast, but there's been many parts of the country are benefiting from that. So it's great to see, because I think at the moment, in order to, you know, address some of our challenges around regional dispersal and growth, we actually need to make sure that our regions have the infrastructure to cope so that we're not dispersing the problems. You know, we are actually, you know, getting our regions ready so they've got a great product, they've got great accommodation, great roading and just general facilities to cope with those potential growth of visitor numbers into their region.
So it feels like the government really is reasonably on side with the work that you guys are doing.
Yeah, like I said, it's definitely an initiative that needs to be driven from both central local government as well as the private sector. And I think at this stage, most of us are on the same page. You know, the government has come out with a tourism draft strategy recently, open for consultation at the moment, and it talks about productive, sustainable and inclusive growth. And we've got, like, you know, recently the industry also launched the Tiaki Promise, which again, you know, really put an emphasis on, you know, highlighting the importance of caring for New Zealand and really helping, you know, our visitors to understand how they should behave and why they should be doing things in a certain way. It's all in line with, you know, to make sure that we are protecting our largest asset in terms of our environment as well as our people.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
That was Judy Chen from the TEC speaking on tourism fatigue and what we can do to stop it happening here.
Thanks very much, Ben. Kei te whakarongo koe. You are listening to 95BFM. You can text us your thoughts on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. We'll be back shortly after this. It's North by North by The Bats.
Some people
Christmas, and the Auckland City Mission and the aunties are doing their annual appeals. Along with the usual non-perishable foods, they're looking for Christmas presents for kids newborn to 17. Anything good, cool stuff that kids like, something the children in your life would want. Please leave unwrapped and drop your gifts off at Ponsby Central between 7am to 11pm. With Auckland City Mission and the aunties, your gifts could make a world of difference for a child in poverty this Christmas. Celebration season, and 95BFM is getting in there, decking the halls, setting the pudding on fire, and making the Yuletide gay with our annual Christmas party. Featuring Amoogie, Cindy, and DJ sets from Christoph El Truento, Peach Milk, and our very own special select BFF DJs. More fun than a family dinner and certified pine free. The 95BFM Christmas Party, December 13th at Neck of the Woods.
Completely free and excellent, thanks to Nando's, Jumping Goat Liquor and Rudy's, Brewers of Beers.
Cheer up, what are you even worried about? Do you believe in climate change or something? Everything's fine, women can vote now. Hashtag feminism.
Concerned for the state of the world today? Want to shine a torch into the darkest crannies of current affairs? Every other week on The Wire is Worry Week, taking a topic of concern and digging in deep.
This week, the militarisation of the Pacific.
Worry Week on The Wire, weekdays 12 to 1 every other week, with your rotating roster of hosts.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and we have an update for a story from Mary Margaret.
Yeah, just a quick story about the allegations about bullying centering around Parliament at the moment. Maggie Barry has arrived at Parliament for the first time since the story broke about the accusations against her. She's asked for an investigation into staff recordings by parliamentary services and is asking if she's ever been recorded by other staff around her. So.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of bullying that's ringing around these past months, whether in the private or public sphere.
It's interesting, eh? Kind of like building on from all that stuff with Russell McVeigh at the start of the year and kind of all the stuff that transpired from that. But they're important conversations to have because clearly we do have a problem with it. So cool. Hope it leads to something good.
And don't forget the speaker's inquiry as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. More to come.
More to come. So if you have any thoughts on that, you can text us on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. But now, let's go to Green Desk.
This is the Green Desk on 95BFM.
For Green Desk this week, Ella is talking to John Sullivan, one of the founders of an app, iNaturalist New Zealand, which Sullivan hopes to drive in its free time. You don't need to worry if you don't know anything about it, because Ella started the interview by asking Sullivan more details of the app.
I don't think a lot of people realise that we're still in this amazing age of discovery with biodiversity, because the bulk of the species around us, still very little is known about them in science. Half of insects don't even have names yet. The ones that do have names, they're on pins in museums. We really don't know much about their biology. It's even worse for fungi and for marine stuff. So there's a whole lot of stuff we just don't know about. And modern technology is kind of opening the doors to let everybody get involved in that discovery, not just the folk that used to work in, and still work in museums and universities. So iNaturalist is kind of opening the doors to natural history for everybody to get involved. So anybody can pick up iNaturalist and make an observation, find out anything that's alive that they find. And if as more and more people are doing that, then we're finding out all this really cool stuff about nature that would have taken ages for the few experts in the country to finally get to, right? So we're really accelerating that age of discovery. And at the same time, I'm sure as you and your listeners all know about it, that the world is changing fast because of all the stuff that's going on with how successful people are on the planet. We're dominating the planet and changing the planet in all sorts of strange ways, and that's having all sorts of both predictable and unpredictable effects on nature. And it's really important to have lots of eyes open observing nature right now, so we can really understand what's going on, so that we can anticipate the problems and kind of look after the place better than we have been in the past. So iNaturalist kind of sits right in the middle of that. It's an online community that is free. Anybody can get involved. It's filled with lots of members of the public, lots of experts, all sort of working together just to explore nature and follow their curiosity. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. It's really exciting. It's a website, it's an app, it's all that stuff that you'd expect from modern technology. It's got a machine learning algorithm that automatically guesses what you find these days before an expert even looks at it. It's pretty cool. The other important thing is all the data that goes into iNaturalist doesn't just stay in iNaturalist. It goes into the International Global Biodiversity Information Facility for everybody to access. So from a science point of view, we are a gateway through into the global biodiversity data set. A lot of other systems out there are like little toy apps, essentially, that kind of everything that goes into them stays in there. Or if you post an image on Facebook, it just stays in Facebook. But everything that goes through iNaturalist goes into the formal, official international biodiversity data set, at least the good data that we can reliably identify. So I think that's an important element of this as well. There's science in this as well as all that nature fun as well.
If you see something that you don't recognize, when you, I guess, upload a picture, the algorithm tries to figure out what it is, and then if it's unsuccessful, then experts look at it, or how exactly does it work?
We look at it anyway, yeah. I mean, as one of the users some years back put, this is better than TV, right? I mean, the people who really like biology are on this in the evenings, watching what's come through that day and reacting to it and commenting on it and checking IDs and all that kind of stuff, so you get lots of feedback anyway. It's like a Facebook for nature nerds from that end, but the public can tap into it just by picking up the free iNaturalist app, taking a photo of anything. The machine learning thing will use our, we've been going for 6 years now, so we've built up a vast library of properly identified photos that we can run machine learning algorithms on, so the system itself can already make a pretty good guess at what you've got, and the app will tell you what it thinks it is straight away if you're online. But once you've uploaded it, somebody will manually check every one of them that comes through as well and correct any mistakes. So it's kind of like Wikipedia in that sense, right? It's always auto-correcting, so it's getting better and better over time. I was just looking at the numbers before. We're growing every year, right? So we launched back in August 2012 as NatureWatch New Zealand. We're now, we kind of joined in with the iNaturalist movement around the world, which started in San Francisco. So we're now the New Zealand node of the iNaturalist network globally, which is why we're going with iNaturalist New Zealand as a brand. It kind of simplifies things a lot. So that means that when you upload an observation of something weird, it's not just the New Zealand experts that are looking at it. It's people all around the world that are looking at this thing and giving you feedback on what things are. Yeah, but so we're growing all the time. I was just looking before. We're up this year so far. We've had 3,455 observers make 117,764 observations of 7,263 species. It's pretty cool. That's up like a quarter from last year. We just grow every year. But 7,200 species is phenomenal, right? When we started this, we figured out, you know, if we make this thing available in New Zealand, and we first made a fork of iNaturalist and made our own New Zealand blend of it as NatureWatch New Zealand before we integrated all the our customization into the mothership of iNaturalist. But when we started, we were thinking, oh, well, you know, this is going to be people like birds, people like plants. We're going to have lots of pictures of birds and plants and maybe the odd dead possum, right? It didn't work out that way at all. As soon as we opened the doors to all of biology, that curiosity about what's that bug in my backyard or what's that fungus I just saw walking down the track, that's what most of it is, right? So, you know, we only have, what, like 2,400 species of native flowering plants. People have made 7,200 observations of species this year. So we've got huge numbers of fungi, huge numbers of invertebrates, huge numbers of marine critters that are coming through this thing. As soon as, if you wanted to identify one of these things old school, you'd have to go to a library and pick up a dusty old book and learn some botanical or some other zoological jargon and try and work your way through some literature. It's really hard. But these days, you just take a photo, your app guesses what it is, somebody confirms it later, and bingo, you can learn anything. I'm a biologist, so I think that's pretty cool.
What are some of the surprising things that you've seen over the years that have shown up through this app?
Oh, heaps, yeah. It kind of works in a few ways. So people have found new species of native things. We had one of our early surprises was the discovery of what's called a poo moss, which is a species of moss that grows on rotting things like poo. And it makes these little colorful spores that flies get attracted to that move their spores off to the next pooey thing. Anyway, that's a long story, but there was a new species that hadn't been seen ever in New Zealand. It's also known from Tasmania, but it was the first record of anywhere in New Zealand. We had a new kind of a fungus that hadn't been seen in more than 40 years. It's called Nevatogastrium baylisianum, and it was on the red list, right, for something that was potentially extinct. And a tramper in inland Otago just walked along this past, saw this thing, they didn't know what it was, took a photo of it, uploaded it onto us. And then Jerry Cooper at Manaaki Whenua Lanke Research Environment, he's a fungal expert in New Zealand, he noticed what it was, identified what it was, got super excited because it hadn't been seen in decades. And then the tramper managed to get him a sample of it, and then they ran the DNA, because they never had DNA done on it, because the old specimens were way too old to have any extractable DNA anymore. And then it turned out to be not even close to what they thought it was, and it was related to this thing that it grows in snowmelt up in Otago, but the closest relative is on a tropical island, subtropical islands in the Pacific. So really, really weird find, all because a tramper was just walking on past and followed their own curiosity and wanted to know what this thing was. Really, really good. We got lots of things like that, and then we also had lots of new records to New Zealand of exotics that hadn't been seen here before. So biosecurity is massive in New Zealand, and the best strategy for dealing with all these new invaders is to catch them really early and then stomp on them before they get established or before they really get settled in. And so having all these eyes open looking for new things is super important. So it's like one of them, the giant willow aphid, first seen on iNaturalist, and then subsequently has spread throughout most of the country over the last 3 years. It's the biggest aphid in New Zealand. It only attacks willows, which, and they're all exotic plants, although some of them are quite valuable in farmland for shelter belts and things.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, these big aphids are now making sugary sap that's then feeding the Vespula wasps and other wasps, which are then building up numbers around the aphid. We didn't stop that one, but there have been lots of other things that have shown up that, I guess pessimistically, most of the things we've found so far we haven't stopped. But one of the examples that came in just in September was we had a local resident of Christchurch City, Alice Shanks, found only the second record ever in the country of this giant veld grass. Veld grass, the regular veld grass from southern Africa, is this horrible pest grass that spreads all around the sides of our tracks and chokes the sides of tracks through forest. It was voted by the New Zealand Conservation Network is the worst weed in New Zealand some years back. Mm. That one. She found a bigger leaved relative of it, only the second time that had ever been seen in the country, growing on the edge of a driveway in Christchurch City. So really important discovery, and the Christchurch City Council has stomped on it now and sprayed that patch, and hopefully we won't see that around again. But that's the kind of stuff that we really need, right? Something shows up for the first time. Somebody says, oh, what's that? I haven't seen that before. Takes a picture of it. Proper authorities get alerted, it gets stomped on, and we don't see it again. So that's cool too.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
If you want to know more about the app, you can visit www.inaturalist.nz.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that's indeed The Wire for another Tuesday. Thank you for everyone who spoke to us today. We've got Professor Steve Latuva, Julie Chin and John Sullivan. And also to my producers, Mary Margaret, Ben and Ella. And thanks to you all for tuning in this rainy day, or should I say sunny right now, to hear me host the show for the first time. Up next is the 1-4 with Jin. We're leaving you right for now for 911 Mr. Lonely by Tyler, the Creator. Normal services should be resumed next week, but until next time, from me, kia ora.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.